This is Liz Siegert, one of the co-producers of Health Cetera. Joining me today is Aaron Tripp, Director of Long-Term Care Policy and Analytics at Leading Age. They're a national not-for-profit working to change our approach towards aging services and ageism. He has authored a new report which outlines a new vision for long-term services and support. Welcome to Health Cetera.
Thank you.
So, Aaron, before we drill down into the report specifics, let's define long-term services and supports. It's not something most of us even think about until we need it or a loved one needs it.
That's correct. I think most people hear the term and don't, it doesn't mean anything to them. I think most people, though, do understand that there are things that we each do on a daily basis just to be. So we move around. Most of us, you know, walk or have, you know, do something to get around. We get dressed in the morning. We eat our meals. We go to a job. And all those sort of components are things that we would refer to as activities of daily living or instrumental activities of daily living. And what long-term services and supports often are providing people with assistance to be able to do those kinds of things. So it's basically the help you need to get through your day.
Now, many people believe that Medicare pays for a lot of this, and they're often shocked to find out otherwise. What does Medicare and even Medicaid pay for, and why do we need another program?
Yeah, I think a lot of people assume that when, you know, most people know when they turn 65, they become eligible for Medicare and assume that that's going to cover all of their health needs. As they get older, most of those folks having reached a retirement age and not no longer having employer insurance. But really what the Medicare system was designed to do was really cover sort of hospital and physician kind of services. So it does cover post-acute care, which for most people might be familiar with if somebody needs a joint replacement or has some kind of issue with their heart and maybe needs to do rehab. Medicare picks up those kind of things. But what they don't pick up is much of the sort of support for daily activities. The Medicaid program, which actually does cover long-term services and supports, is really designed for people who need a safety net. Folks who have very low incomes and assets can qualify for Medicaid. And a lot of the money that Medicaid spends is for the population of folks that do need long-term services and supports. These aren't just older people. These aren't just people in nursing homes. People who need long-term service and supports range from young children with intellectual and developmental disabilities through physical disabilities that you might occur as an adult, right through issues that are largely prevalent in an aging population. So Medicaid, on a state-by-state basis, might look different because states have a role in designing their program, but most states offer long-term services and supports through waiver programs, and that gives opportunity to have access to a lot of the different types of services and supports that sort of make up a state's long-term services and supports program.
So what about the people who make too much money to qualify for Medicaid? What do they do when it comes to needing this kind of care?
Right. So a lot of people don't, you know, aren't thinking that this is something that's going to happen to them. And most people aren't necessarily planning for the risk that they might need long-term service and supports. So one thing that we know from recent research, for people that age to 65 years old and older, at that point past age 65, slightly more than half of all people will need long-term services and supports at some point. Medicare doesn't really cover that. Medicaid might, but for the population that doesn't qualify for Medicaid, the two big things that we're seeing in terms of care is three-quarters of those folks are likely getting supports just from their family or friends in an unpaid manner. So the vast majority of people with long-term service and supports needs are not having it paid for by any kind of a formal program. And there is a small portion, the most recent data that I believe we have was from 2014 that showed about 11% of the population has actually proactively bought long-term care insurance policies. So for that 11%, they have purchased insurance protection to help cover those costs. don't fall into having insurance or qualifying for Medicaid, it's a lot of either unpaid family care or money that just has to be spent out of people's pockets.
And that can get very expensive.
Yeah. What we know is that on average, the lifetime expected cost is $138,000. And that for people who have long-term service supports need for a long duration, so 5 years or more, it's about 15% of the people that need that. Their lifetime cost will often exceed $250,000. Most people can't plan and save for that. So that's sort of a lot of the motivation for why we think we need to do a better job of providing financing and services for our population.
Let's talk a little bit about what you mean by a new vision.
Sure. So two things are really have been sort of drivers for this topic in terms of the attention that people have given to it. One, with the fact that so many people are just getting care from their families, we know that the families that are providing care for their friends and loved ones are doing so at a disadvantage. They often are not trained. For many people, they're either having to leave the workforce or cut back on their hours, so they're losing earning and savings potential for their own potential long-term service and support needs. But they're also hurting business productivity. And we're not letting families be families. We're turning families into sort of untrained paraprofessional medical staff. And that's not the best role for families. And we also know on the Medicaid side that with the split share between the federal government and the state government, it's really taking a big chunk from state budgets. And we need to have a program that's a bit more rational for folks, those needing care, those paying for care, government, so that we're not overburdening families and bankrupting states.
So the report looks at three key takeaways, a universal approach, a catastrophic benefit, and a managed care benefit. As soon as you say the word universal, I can almost feel the hackles rising on Capitol Hill. Do you expect that you're going to get some blowback from Congress on anything that says universal anything?
Absolutely. I mean, we know that the political environment right now, particularly after having seen how the healthcare reform debate writ large has sort of played out, we know that there's a real pushback against universal or mandatory or any synonym that we want to use. But the research and the data was really hard to argue for something other than that. If you look at a voluntary program, even if you looked at a voluntary program that offered subsidies to try to help mitigate costs for folks with lower incomes, you just didn't even come close to really addressing the issue. With a universal program, as you know, the name implies, you're basically going to be able to cover virtually everybody. When we looked at what would the take-up be in a voluntary-style program, you were only seeing numbers pick up a little bit over the long-term care insurance market right now. So even if, you know, if you're only getting to 15, maybe 20%, you're really not making a real dent in the issue. So we feel pretty strongly about the universal, and we have seen in conversations that we've had with sort of policy think tank folks and researchers and policymakers that there is definitely some recognition sort of across the ideological spectrum about the validity of our findings. It seems like we're getting to a hang up on, you know, the politics and certainly some on the cost, but in terms of sort of agreeing that what the data says and what the research saying and sort of what the approach that makes most sense, if you can, you know, sort of step aside from some of the obstacles that we'll have to overcome, I think we've sold a lot of people on the why our recommendations make sense around universal.
Just to clarify, what we're talking about is a universal long-term care insurance plan, funded similarly to how Medicare and Social Security are funded now, with slight deductions out of an employee's paycheck.
So that's the most common model. We haven't put forth a specific proposal that would define that, but generally that probably makes the most sense. It's one of the more simpler methods and is one that people are familiar with.
The other thing that the report calls for is a catastrophic kind of benefit. Can you explain that a little and maybe give an example?
Sure. So when we looked at people that need long-term services and supports, and how we defined it often in the research is people needing help with two or more activities of daily living and or some kind of a cognitive deficit, so like folks with Alzheimer's disease or other dementias. So if you meet that definition, the way that we talk about catastrophic is sort of looking at the time period of risk that a program would be covering. So you meet that definition, you would start needing services that day and going to whatever endpoint that is. If you cover the whole thing, that would be comprehensive, is how we would refer to it. If you cover the first part, and any of these durations you can sort of, you know, move the numbers on, but let's say your first 2 years of needing long-term services supports, that's often referred to as sort of front-end coverage. And catastrophic, as we've defined it, looks at sort of back-end coverage in a way. So what we recommended is after somebody has long-term services and supports needs for 2 years, the catastrophic program would kick in at that point and pay for their needs from that time through the duration of their long-term services and supports needs.
And what about the managed cash benefit? It sounds good, but how do you ensure that people will actually spend a cash allotment on the services that they actually need?
If you think about the major programs for older adults that we have right now, the two big ones that come to mind would be Medicare and Social Security. So if we take those as examples, for Medicare, it's a pretty traditional health insurance program where it reimburses for services. And they're fairly, you know, rigid definitions of what those services are and what the coverage amount is. We know that the service and supports needs for people that need long-term service and supports, they're not those supports that they need are not always as easily defined and as sort of regimented as medical care is. So a straight service reimbursement doesn't make as much sense for us, because we do know for some people who do have savings or have planned for this, sometimes even with the money to go and purchase service and supports, what they want might not exist out there today. There may not be a named service that they can spend that money on and get sort of like in a health insurance medical care kind of model. On the flip side, on the Social Security side, which is a pure, you know, income supplement type of a benefit, while in many cases additional income to be able to have sort of flexibility in how you use those dollars is often something that people and families who have a loved one with long-term service supports needs say that they want, we also know that the service delivery system is not set up in such a manner that it's easy to, if I were just to say, you know what, here is, you know, $100 a day to help your dad who's got long-term service and supports needs, it's hard to then have somebody know how to go out and use that or what, where to spend that, who to spend that with. So the idea of a managed cash benefit would be to allow for the flexibility and being able to really target sort of a person and family-centered needs, but give them that sort of care coordination, navigation kind of support so that you would have sort of a partner with you to help be able to use those dollars in the way that makes the most sense given your situation. And we also think that flexibility might also sort of continue to promote innovation in the aging services arena, so that those things that people may want today that they can't spend money on, that having that flexibility that's away from the rigidity of a service reimbursement, we might be able to promote that kind of innovation for people.
There's also people that say that the need for long-term care is just part of aging and it should be up to the families. Why should the government step in with another program?
There's certainly some thought about that. But what I would say in that regards, you know, if we go back to some of the earlier points with the expense that are related to these kind of things, it would be very difficult for most people, even if we were able to get past the known knowledge barriers in terms of what is sort of the prevalence of needing long-term services and supports and what kind of care options are available. If we had a completely educated public that understood the risks, it's still hard for a lot of people to be able to, whether they're saving independently, whether they're purchasing what are often expensive long-term care insurance policies. It's just a difficult ask for most American families to do on their own. And when you look at more than half of people that are going to be 65 or older will need that care, that kind of risk just is a definition of something that would be solved with an insurance approach. Being able to spread that risk across our population base makes it more manageable for all of us. You know, in the way that, you know, when you have a car, you've got to have automobile insurance and you have homeowners insurance. And we do those things, insure against those risks in case something bad might happen to us. And I think we want to let people know that while, yes, needing long-term services and supports, your chances of that happening as you get older increase, but it's not a only those unlucky few folks who might end up in a nursing home. It could happen to most of us, and there ought to be a manner in which our government can help facilitate the spreading of that risk so that we all can be able to insure against that risk.
There are already some states that have started to take steps. They're not waiting for Congress to come up with a plan and or adopt part of your plan and get it through. I know Hawaii's doing some things. Can you talk a little bit about what's happening a little more locally?
Sure. Yeah, it feels like the momentum on this topic has sort of shifted to some extent from Washington, D.C. to the states. There was a lot of interest and activity, you know, sort of around the Affordable Care Act and then with the repeal of the CLASS Act and a lot of talk about what's going on in federal. We know some of the obstacles that we face that we just talked about in terms of political ideology and costs, but, you know, this really affects families, and you do have a number of states who said we might not be able to solve the problem for our residents, but you know what, there's things that we can do. So Hawaii was a terrific example. They have the new Kupuna Caregivers Program, which is offering a benefit to families who are caring for an older loved one. And I believe the benefit level is at a $60 a day, I believe is the benefit level. And it's really to help support families who are caring for their older adults. You've got states that are looking at both similar and different approaches. There's mm-hmm. Washington State has had legislation introduced the past several years that is actually more similar to sort of the universal catastrophic type of approach. And they've got, there's a large sort of policy advocacy network out there called the Washingtonians for a Responsible Future. It's really brought together a pretty diverse set of stakeholders that care about this topic and think that they can help address it on a state level. You've got other states that are sort of looking at some of these early innovators, if you will, that are looking at similar type of approaches. So there's a group of sort of stakeholder advocates up in Maine that is trying to get a universal home care benefit through a ballot referendum. You've got activity in the state of California that have been, you know, looking at their neighbors to the north up in Washington and saying, is the legislation that Washington has been working on, is there something along those lines that we could adopt for California? You also have some states that have looked at, so one of the things that is under state authority as opposed to federal authority is the regulation of insurance. Mm-hmm. And so you've had some states that have taken a real interest in looking at long-term care insurance regulations and seeing are there things that they could do with state insurance commissioners that might help make the private long-term care insurance market more readily available for people. So I think there's certainly real recognition that at the state level that this is a serious issue and really taking a hard look at saying what are the tools that we have at our disposal if we can't wait on Washington, D.C. to come up with a federal answer for us.
What happens to these millions of people that are already in the over 65 demographic and the millions more at some point be needing these services or are already using services or needing services for their loved ones? What happens if we don't address it now?
Well, it will only continue to get worse the longer that it takes to address it. That said, there are some challenges by the nature of where we already are in terms of the aging of our society. So with the approach that Leading Age recommends, with sort of looking at this as a problem that you can solve through social insurance, even if we had the political environment today where we could enact this style of a program, you're already looking at going out probably 5 to 10 years because it is something where we think you should pre-fund. So you would essentially need to start to build up reserves before you can start paying out benefits, because we want to be responsible stewards of sort of the public trust, public funds, that this isn't something that you would just start giving out benefits without having a method to sort of build up the reserves that you would need to pay out. So for people today, that style program doesn't help them today. That said, we need to both look at what do we do for folks today. So are there other style programs that can help folks today? But we really also need to be looking at how do we build for the future, because even though we've got this baby boomer generation, we know that once they, sort of age through, that it doesn't all of a sudden shrink again, that we essentially sort of keep this number of people coming through. So the longer that we put off trying to solve this in a systemic way, it just means we'll continue to put pressure on families and continue to put pressure on our Medicaid budgets.
So how can our listeners take some action or learn more about this issue if they want to get involved?
I would say the number one thing that I would tell people is get educated. There's a lot of great resources and research that's been done on this topic. So everything from, looking up what are care options for folks that need long-term service and support. So familiarize yourselves. A lot of people, when they think about this, their first reaction is, I don't want to be sent to the home. I don't want my kids to put me in a home. Have those conversations with your family and friends. We when you start a job, many places have disability insurance. So you sort of have to think about, if something happens to me, what am I going to do? Let's have those conversations about long-term services and supports. It's not a scary thing. It's something that is part of normal development. So I would encourage people to just sort of understand the risk and also start to say, well, what would you want? Do you want to have, your sons and daughters helping you at home? Do you want, would you be comfortable in an assisted living community? Or, if you have severe needs, would you feel more comfortable or better off in a nursing home community? I mean, there are folks that, do very well in all the different types of settings that we have today. So I would say understand what the risks are and sort of start to think about what your preferences would be. And then I would say communicate those with your family. So it's not such a shock to the system, because this is a big shock to a lot of families. And then start to do something. At this point, on a family or personal level, look at what would long-term care insurance be. Start to think about savings. But also with that, knowing that it's very difficult for a lot of people to take this on just themselves, that really start to have the educate your policymakers, your folks in your state capitals and in D.C., to let them know that this is an issue that's going to affect all of us, and that the situation as it exists today is just not sustainable, and that we really need government to partner with families so that as people reach the point where they need long-term services and supports, that those supports are available for all of us, regardless of where we live or how much money we make.
And if they wanted to download a copy of the report or find out more about Leading Age, what's the URL for that?
So it's leadingage.org So spelled out is one word, and you can find our most recent report, and we've got some reports from years past, because this topic has been an important one for us for at least the last 15 or so years. We've been pretty active in this topic, and I would certainly encourage people to take a look at the resources and reports that we have on our website.
Aaron Tripp, author of a new report from Leading Age, A New Vision for Long-Term Services and Supports. Thank you for joining us today on HealthCetera.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
This is Liz Siegert.